Chapter 15. "What the hell?" Django says without looking up. "Do you think you're doing in here, old man?" "There's no need for that tone," Jaster says, though his heart isn't in it. He closes the door of Django's room behind him, looking for a clear seat, but can't spot one. There's a half-disassembled droid on one chair, a stack of manuals on another, a tangle of half-polished armor on the couch. Django's boots and his kit are at the very least clear of the mess, set to one side and clearly ready to go, but the chaos makes Jaster smile a little. Django has changed immensely from the furious, grieving boy he pulled out of the field, but at the same time, he's still precisely the same person. Brilliant and moody, with clear priorities and no willingness to let anyone get in the way of them. And a penchant for leaving his room an absolute disaster zone, of course. Django snorts, but he leans over to shove his flight suit off the foot of the bed, and Jaster takes it as the invitation it's intended to be. "I think there is," Django tells him, but he sits up, leaning back against the wall and raising a brow. Did Miles just defect to the Death Watch or something? "Miles would never," Jaster says, offended by the very idea. Django just gives him a look, flat and disbelieving, and Jaster grimaces, running a hand through his hair. "Miles is too preoccupied with pulling off a functional wedding to think about running anywhere," he corrects, and feels something dark and nauseous turn in the pit of his stomach at the thought of what will happen in 4 days. Everything he wants, but that's the problem, isn't it? "I don't want to talk about the wedding with you," Django says, maybe a little warily. "A happy coincidence," Jaster says dryly. "I would also prefer not to talk about it." There's a pause, just long enough to notice. When Jaster looks up, Django is staring at him, his expression sliding from wariness into outright despair. "Criff," he mutters, and thumps his head back against the wall. "I'm on too many painkillers for this." "Are you all right?" Jaster asks, concerned, and he straightens, already reaching for his comm. Django is barely 2 weeks out from truly grievous injuries, only just released from medical, and if he needs to go back to living on a biobed, Jaster is more than happy to make him. Django catches his wrist before he can even hit the button, pointedly tugging his hand away. "I'm fine," he says. "The medical droids were just here, but you look like you're dying, and the other day you were carrying that Jedi around like he was made of Beskar. What happened?" "I thought you didn't want to talk about this," Jaster says half-heartedly, but he has to look away. Easy to remember John on the night Django went wandering off, the way he twitched when Jaster got too close in sliding to his knees. Easy, too, to remember all the other flinches right now, the careful wariness even in the first moments. John doesn't seem like he's outright afraid of him, but he reacts like he's expecting Jaster to hurt him, to hit him. He reacts like he believes Jaster could. And yet, even with all of that, he's chosen to go along with the marriage. He's chosen to give in to all of Jaster's demands from him, all the spoken ones and all the ones Jaster has just thought about, guiltily, secretly, when he's lying with John curled against him in the dark. Jaster knows, intellectually, that Jedi are empaths. It's one of the things all the reputable literature agrees on. And some edge of fear has lodged itself beneath his skin, carried on the realization that John must know that Jaster wants him. And for the sake of the marriage, for the sake of pleasing Jaster and reducing the chances of Jaster beating him, John is willing to offer up his body. Just the thought is enough to make Jaster sick. To be the one with the power, with all the control in this situation, to know that he could free John with a word but that he won't, because he values the future of his people more than any one man's freedom. It's wretched. The Death Watch hit another outpost, Django says into the silence. Did Arla tell you? Another one. The words jar through Jaster's chest, ice cold and heavy. It's their first large attack in a while, but not unexpected. The Death Watch hasn't given them more than a few weeks of peace at a time since the war began. No, Jaster says, raising his head. When? About an hour ago, Django says, and he's watching Jaster, something unreadable in his eyes. 10 casualties. The base is mostly gone, too. The Death Watch burned it on their way out. I sent a ship out to check the area, and the survivors made it to the next base, but now there's only one outpost left above Bonegal. 10 Mandalorians, dead. And out of the bases on 17 of Bonegal's 34 moons, they're down to one. Most of Bonegal's moons are either farming worlds or mining ones, and either way, supplies just tightened. Jaster breathes in, then out, on a grim sound, and asks, any word of movement threatening Mandalia? There were reports of hit-and-run attacks against factories there, but... Small cells, Django says with a shrug, though his mouth is a tight line. A squad of journeyman protectors there found one group, but they didn't have any apparent links to anyone else. Planned to bomb one of the water treatment plants, apparently. Criff. Jaster leans forward, rubbing at his brow as he tries to think. They don't have enough bodies. Too many clans are still holding themselves back, waiting to see who wins this civil war. Jaster is the Mandalore in name, but half the warrior clans believe that a 1,000-year-old lightsaber, forged by a Jedi long before he was Mandalore, means that Tor has the absolute right to rule. The super commandos are Jaster's, sworn and signed, and he has enough troops for basic protection of most outposts, but he doesn't have men to guard every single base on every single world, and then protect the infrastructure around those bases as well. And with anyone else, they might hesitate to target those keeping well out of the fighting, but Tor has never met a moral he isn't eager to desecrate. He'll resort to any methods, any underhanded tactics, and Jaster can't protect everyone. They're supposed to be winning this war. Tor's men are thugs, vicious and cruel and without discipline. Jaster's troops follow a higher standard, believe in honor and dignity and the nobility of fighting well and respectably. And Jaster believes in that, of course he does, because he carved it into his own bones and made it the core of who he is, but we've lost so many, he says. And Django curls a hand around his shoulder, grips, but doesn't say anything. There's nothing left to say. He's getting married in 4 days, Jaster thinks, and drags his hand over his face. 4 days, and then he can push for Senate recognition via his ties to the Jedi. Mandalorian space isn't part of the Republic, but in a nebulous way, which allows enough trade that recognition will make a difference. And it might help sway those who find all of the fighting distasteful, but just want to live in peace. And the Senate will have to recognize him as Mandalore, or that leaves one of their Jedi tied to a nameless warlord at the edges of their space, and that's bad for optics if nothing else. Ossic, Jaster mutters, and raises his head. I hate politics. Django is watching him, a strange look on his face. Something wary and a little hunted and a fair bit mulish, but when Jaster casts him a glance, he looks away. Seems stupid to have signed up for it then, Django points out, and Jaster reaches out and thumps him lightly on top of the head. The other option was leave Tor to claim the position, he reminds Django. Django promptly pulls a face and sinks back against the pillows. He's silent for a long moment, but then he sighs, drops his head back, and closes his eyes. Are you sleeping in here and avoiding that, Jedi? I wouldn't want to ruin your decorating strategy, Jaster says dryly, shoving a pile of data pads lightly with one toe. It teeters precariously, but doesn't fall. How do the droids even manage to get in here? How has Sylas not fallen and broken his neck yet? Sylas is fine, Django says grumpily, rolling his eyes. Get out then, sleep in the hall or something, old man. Jaster snorts, but he leans over, taps his forehead against Django's, and smiles when Django's arm loops around his neck and squeezes in a lazy hug. Don't do anything stupid until after my wedding, Jaster says. I need both of my witnesses present. Django grunts, disgusted, but cracks an eye open to give him a narrow look. I'll be there. Arla won't let me skip. Jaster laughs, closing his eyes and ruffling his son's hair, just like he used to when Django was a child. Django doesn't do more than swear at him for it, which is practically tearful acceptance coming from him, and Jaster focuses on the moment, on the solutions, and doesn't let himself linger on the sick, dark dread that's knotted in the pit of his stomach at the thought of the wedding that's creeping ever closer. Maybe we should go with the green, Zarin says, frowning faintly. As long as he doesn't look like a tree, Arla says, without looking up from her pad. It doesn't do anything to hide her smirk. He already looms too much as it is. John grimaces just a little, though he doesn't try to shift. There are rather too many pins to attempt that safely. He doesn't have a preference on color, either, and no ability to pretend he does, which is likely why Arla is here. No brown, then, Zarin says with good humor, circling John. I do like the black and red, I'll admit. It's striking next to Jaster's armor. At the very least, there aren't any Sith left for John to be mistaken for if they do dress him in red and black. He glances past Zarin, towards the table where she's laid her bolts of cloth, and hesitates for a moment before he asks quietly, "Blue?" Zarin blinks, turns to look, and pauses. She skims her fingers over the cobalt cloth, then casts John an assessing look and hums. "It is a pretty blue," she says, "and that one's blaster resistant, too." "I have a feeling we'll need all the help we can get at the wedding," Arla says, a little dry. "Done with him, Zarin." "Should be," she agrees easily, and steps closer to help John slide out of the pinned cloth. Arla pointedly raises her pad to block her view of him, and John feels a flicker of relief, getting the robes off and then quickly reaching for his own. "Arla, I'll need to look over your armor, too. Jaster already dropped his off with me, and I have Django's and Miles's as well. You're the only holdout." Arla grimaces, deeply unhappy with the reminder. John can feel her disquiet, the flicker of an old, well-worn fear, and after a second, she lets out a heavy breath and asks, "Willing to come over to my rooms to do it? I'll make it worth your while." Her lazy smirk almost manages to blot out her unsettled edge. Zarin doesn't notice. She laughs, tucking a few stray pins into her head wrap, and says, "All right, if that's your preference, tomorrow night I should be free." Arla's relief doesn't show on her face, but John can feel it clear as day. "Perfect, I'll get us dinner even." "All the fancy bits of a booty call," Zarin says cheerfully, and waves John off the stool. "All right, you should be done for good. I'll send the robes over when they're finished. Arla, he's all yours." "All my father's," Arla says with a snort, and John flushes, tugs the hood up and forward. He joins Arla as she rises and heads for the door, and in the hallway outside Zarin's rooms, she sighs, stretches, and winces as her back pops. "Jester's hiding from you, isn't he?" she says after a moment. It's not a question, so John doesn't bother answering. He looks ahead of them, to where the fields around the compound stretch on for kilometers, and then says, "It won't be for long." Arla huffs, amused. "If he tries to avoid the wedding, Miles will skin him," she agrees, then casts a sideways look at John, her eyes thoughtful. "All right." John hesitates, takes two steps towards the window. He hardly noticed it before, but there's a tug in his chest, quietly insistent, and when he closes his eyes, certainty is easy to find, direction obvious. "I need to leave," he says quietly. Arla stops. There's a long, long second of silence, and then she asks, a little coolly, "Just because of Jaster, that's enough to make you abandon ship?" John blinks, coming back to himself, and turns to look at her. "I'm not abandoning ship," he says after a second. "A Jedi is in trouble." Arla stares at him, a strange expression on her face. A Jedi in the Mandalore system? Closing his eyes, John tugs at the feeling, breaks it apart to inspect it. Somewhere just outside of it, he says. The Gargan system. Well, Arla says after another moment, she sounds amused. At least your mystical energy sense comes with coordinates. The wedding's in 4 days. The sense of urgency is getting stronger, like it was just waiting for John to acknowledge it before it grew. He can feel the hum of it settling into his bones, an insistent itch that says he should be moving, should be going, that someone needs him and he can help. I'll be back in time. Arla looks at him for a long moment, then groans quietly. Miles is going to skin me, she mutters, and pulls her helmet on. Come on, if I find you a fast ship, that should at least help you get there in time. Thank you, John says quietly, and falls into step with her when she turns right instead of left. He can't move as fast as he would like, but the Force wouldn't give him a path if he couldn't walk it. There's a Jedi in danger, and he needs to help. You just know, Arla asks, curious. One look outside and it just hits you like a prophecy. Does every Jedi get the same warning bell behind their eyes? John hides his smile behind the fall of his hood. You sound just like Jaster, he says. Arla stops dead in the middle of the hallway, and John can't see her face, but he can feel the surge of horror and denial, and then disbelief. You take that back, she orders, stabbing a finger at John. Take it back now! John raises his hands, laughing silently as he takes 2 steps back. With a growl, Arla follows, raising her fists like she's going to pummel him. That is a slander, JT, and I won't have it. Exactly like, John says, and ducks one of her half-hearted jabs. Do you have any idea, Arla says, aggravated, how many times I've had to listen to his stupid lectures when all I wanted was to walk down a city street in peace? Are we assaulting the Jedi now? Jango asks from where he's leaning against the corner. It's almost casual enough to hide the fact that he's using the wall for support. Dumping his body in a shallow grave. He said I'm like Jaster, Arla says, outraged, and John can't quite catch his breath from laughter. Hits the wide window and feels Arla haul him forward. She puts him in a headlock, then says, entirely annoyed, stop snickering or you're next, Jango. Jango doesn't stop snickering, even when he has to slide down to sit on a bench like his legs are about to give way. You're a griffing nerd, it's official, he tells Arla, delighted by it, and his grin is all teeth and dare. With a sound of deep-seated offense, Arla lets go of John and stalks towards Jango instead, and Jango laughs as she smacks at him, thumping him over the head and then around the ears. He shoves, but she's in full armor and doesn't even sway, just drags him in and grinds her knuckles into his hair. Jango yelps, struggling, and demands, Griffing, help me, Jedi! Are your books full of notes, too? John asks, mild, and Arla hisses at him in offense, looking between him and Jango like she can't decide who the better target is. I'm going to dump you both in a sandpit, she says disgustedly. You'd better hope I don't give you the worst ship in the lot. A ship? Jango asks, grabbing Arla's wrist to stop her knuckles. He kicks, wriggles, elbows, and finally slides out of her grasp, frowning deeply as he looks from Arla to John. You're running? Is that why the old man was twisting himself up in knots? What the hell did you do? I'm not running, John says patiently. A Jedi needs my help close by. Jango scowls, thumps his elbow against Arla's thigh. Then I'm coming, he says. If you disappear before the wedding, Jaster's going to self-destruct. Nobly. Because he's an idiot. You can't even walk 10 meters without help, Arla tells Jango, shoving his head down. And you just faced off against an assassin, she adds, giving John a pointed look. Neither of you should be going anywhere, either together or alone. John opens his mouth to protest, but before he can even start, Jango snorts loudly. So you're coming, he needles. Of course I'm coming, Arla says witheringly. The two of you will get yourselves killed within 10 minutes without me. How far to the Gargan system? Jango blinks. Gargan? Maybe 6 hours in a fast ship. Then I won't have to bail on Zarin if we leave now. She eyes John, then tips her head. Need anything? John has his lightsaber, the heavy new cloak Zarin made. He shakes his head, still trying to process the fact that this has turned from his mission into their mission, and then says carefully, "It's to rescue a Jedi." "One more Jedi in our debt," Arla says, unbothered. "I don't see anything wrong with that. I'll calm Tori and get her to cover my rounds. Django, let Silas know or he's going to have a heart attack before he's 30. "Silas is fine. I don't work him that hard," Django says. It sounds like a common refrain. Pushing to his feet, he winces faintly, but manages to stay upright well enough. "Your ship?" "Well, we're not taking yours," Arla retorts. "Then I'm flying," Django counters, and Arla drags her helmet off just to make a face at him. This, John reflects with a trace of amusement, is going to be an interesting rescue attempt. It is, Miles thinks, almost suspiciously quiet. Sitting back in his chair, he eyes his cleared desk, the neat stacks of completed work, all the files in their correct location. He can't remember the last time he had a long enough stretch of hours completely to himself to allow him to actually finish a day's work, and it feels strange, suspicious. Like if he opens his door, he's going to find the compound a steaming pile of rubble, with his office the only intact piece remaining. In light of that, he's a little reluctant to so much as stand up from his desk. Warily, Miles eyes his comm, quiescent on his desk, then the shadowy corners of the office, but there are no lurking Jedi either, no waiting messages. Everyone leaving him alone for a whole afternoon is completely unheard of, and he doesn't quite know what to make of it. Still, Miles is a Mandalorian and a Corran, and the furthest thing from a coward. He pushes up from his chair, snags his comm, and goes to key open the door, then leans out. The hallway outside is entirely empty, but he can see through the closest window that there's a guard patrol moving along the wall, another just outside the building. Nothing seems to be on fire, and nothing's collapsed, and Miles doesn't like this at all. When he makes his way to Jaster's quarters, it's to find the door open, quiet sounds within. Raising a brow, he leans against the door, watching Jaster settle a handful of clothes in a bag, along with several more books than Miles thinks is strictly necessary, and then says, "If you're the one running away before the wedding, I think I'm legally allowed to hunt you for sport." Jaster twitches, raises his head. "I'm simply moving to another room for a few nights," he says with dignity. "I think it would be better for all involved." Maybe Miles is legally allowed to hunt him for sport just for general stupidity. He deserves it. Jaster probably deserves it too. With a sigh, Miles rubs the bridge of his nose, thinking of John's confession about kissing Jaster, and wonders why his Mandalore has to be noble. Well, he likely wouldn't be Miles's Mandalore if he wasn't, but still. "This is still about you being attracted to John," he observes. Jaster doesn't technically need to know that John came to him already. "I thought taking Arla's spot and almost drowning in your sleep cured you of trying to avoid him." Jaster wavers, then sighs. He sits down heavily on the bed, and after a moment, Miles crosses the room, sinks down beside him, and braces their shoulders together. "Jedi don't marry," Jaster says after a long moment. "They likely have no concept of it, given that they're raised in their own community, and public interpretations of such matters have less bearing on the truth than they could. I don't want someone who had no choice in this marriage to assume they have no choices in other things as well." Miles blinks, runs that through a mental translator, reassesses it, then rolls his eyes. "He's not a child, Jaster," he says, exasperated. "John knows perfectly well what an arranged marriage entails and what it doesn't. You made that much clear. And he knows you." "Does he?" Jaster casts him a rueful smile. He still flinches. "And I can hardly blame him. He was taken by the Jedi's traditional enemies." "Jaster," Miles says, "you're not going to assault him." "Coercion," Jaster says, merciless with himself the way he always is. That's counted as assault in most systems. Miles raises a brow, considering him. I meant you wouldn't hit him, he says after a moment, and Jaster winces. You know, a good counter for coercion is open discussion. Jedi aren't generally celibate, and you aren't either. No one's going to blink if you look for sex outside your marriage, because what the two of you decide is your business, but if the two of you want to sleep with each other, that would seem to be a good solution. John can't want to sleep with me if he fears what I'm going to do to him, Jaster says, rough in his throat, and Miles can hear the exhaustion in it, the guilt, the grief. He lets out a quiet breath, then thumps their shoulders together lightly. Just talk to him before you run for cover, he says. Jedi are honest about their emotions. It's part of their thing. If you ask outright, he'll tell you. Yes, Jaster says ruefully, but he grips Miles' forearm, squeezes gently. And then I'll know. He's an idiot, Miles thinks with a snort, and grabs him by the collar, hauls him up off the bed and onto his feet. All right, enough fatalism. I'm finished with work and there are still a few hours of daylight, so I'm going to make sure you're too sore from hitting the mat to brood. Jaster laughs, bats his hand away. Miles, I'm about to be a married man. Miles thumps his Mandalore's head against the doorframe on their way out of the room and feels absolutely no shame in it. End of chapter 15.